This is incredibly powerful. And it is one of the most, I think, powerful business concepts ever, because the issue that we faced today, even 10 years on, if Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and the big banks decided to gang up on Proton, they can still do the same thing to us today, right? So from that moment to today, I think I've always been an advocate of how can we get this powerful concept that enabled Proton to survive, 10 years ago, and make it more widespread and make it more common, because I think the future of business, democracy, freedom, it really depends on this.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 860780, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Andy Yen. Andy is the CEO and founder of Proton. Not only does Proton offer encrypted email, VPN, file storage, and a password manager, but they recently announced they're launching Proton Wallet, a self-custodial Bitcoin-only wallet, which is currently in beta, but which will soon be available to their 100 million users worldwide. Andy and I dig into the creation of Proton by himself and other physicists at CERN, the early days and how they first got introduced to Bitcoin back in 2014 and why, how Proton Wallet actually works to both protect your privacy and provide a great user experience, Proton versus Google, the overall Proton ethos, Proton's move to become a nonprofit, plus a whole lot more. I really enjoyed this discussion with Andy. It was super fascinating, and I think you are going to love this conversation and hearing more about Proton Wallet. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you are listening or watching, and check out my sponsor Bitbox in the show notes. Or you can just go directly to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You can also grab links to protect yourself from SIM swap attacks using Ifani or Cloaked Wireless. I am a one-man show, so when you use my partner links, it genuinely helps me keep this show running, and I really appreciate it. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and on Noster via Highlighter and Flare.pub. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcasts, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters to give value for value, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this and other podcasts. And if you're already listening to the Bitcoin Podcast on Fountain and you've given this show a boost or shared clips, I just want to thank you. It really means a lot when you support this show. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media or via the website bitcoinpodcast.net or shoot me an email. It's hello@bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Andy Yen. Andy, welcome. Thanks for coming on the Bitcoin Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've heard a bit about your show, and I think your users are probably, or your listeners are probably our users. So glad to give some answers, insight, and show a bit what's going on behind the scenes at Proton.
Absolutely. And I'm a Proton user myself. I've been for a number of years now. I was very happy also to when I discovered you guys had a VPN product that allowed me to get rid of my Express VPN, which was kind of garbage, to be honest. So I like Proton a lot. Full disclosure, I am in no way, for anyone listening, sponsored by Proton or anything like that. I just really enjoy the product. And I'll be honest, when you guys dropped the Proton Wallet announcement, at least for me, it felt kind of out of the blue in a very good way. I was thinking, wow, this is really cool. I love Proton as a service, used it for a while. You guys have a lot of users. And this seemed like something that was just a very pleasant surprise. I'm just thinking, wow, okay, Proton's been working on this behind the scenes and now they're coming out with a wallet. I've got a bunch of questions for you, but maybe we could just start out so that people get to know you a little bit better. Who are you? How did you get here today to be building a privacy-focused email and whole tech stack that is, you know, competing with Google?
Yeah, well, thanks for your support. It's always great to, you know, talk to someone that knows and uses the product. And it's people like you and also members of your audience that really make our work possible, right? So, you know, first of all, thanks for that. A bit about me. I think in some sense, I'm kind of an anomaly in the tech, crypto, you know, Bitcoin space, right? What do you have in this space? You've got like maybe the really technical computer science, you know, hacking types, although there's fewer and fewer of those, right? You've got a lot of what I might call like the business bros who came out of, you know, business school somewhere, want to make a buck, you know, have some idea and decide this is the best way to make money, right? And then people like me who are the real scientists, you know, I did my PhD in particle physics, right? So I'm actually a scientist originally. I find there aren't so many of us in this space. And I think that's maybe the history that makes, you know, Proton a little bit different. You know, we were not an idea cooked up in a business school, you know, seminar, right? It was something that really came out at the beginning as a project, a passion project between me and some friends when we were working back at CERN. That's a European Center for Nuclear Research. And we were actually physicists, you know, working at the Large Hadron Collider, the biggest particle accelerator in the world, here in Geneva, Switzerland. And from there, that was around the time, actually, of the Edward Snowden leaks. This is 2013, so it was actually 10 years ago. And we looked at it and we said, wow, you know, government surveillance is really bad, but actually corporate surveillance is way worse, right? If you consider what the NSA has on you compared to what Google and Facebook has, it's a drop in the bucket. So we thought, well, that's a really difficult problem. And as a scientist, what attracts you? You're attracted to very difficult problems because you like the intellectual challenge of the problems. You're not really so concerned about, let's say, making money, because if you wanted to get rich, you don't go into science, right? It's not really the most lucrative career for most people. And I can tell you, PhD students are not paid very well, right? But you want hard problems that could potentially improve the state of the world and are interesting to work on. So the whole privacy problem of how we actually get privacy back in the 21st century, that seemed quite fascinating. And that was kind of how we started going down the rabbit hole and I started thinking of this problem. And the benefit of being a scientist is, you know technology, you know how to program, you can code, you know how servers and infrastructure work. So unlike other people who thought, oh, you know, that's an interesting problem, I want to fix it. I was actually in a position to do something about it and actually work on the problem. And that was really how we kind of, you know, got going. What made Proton also very different from the very beginning was it was always very community focused. You know, if people, most people don't remember this anymore, but some of the folks that have been with us in the beginning will probably remember. At the beginning, it was actually a beta product. It was something that, you know, there was a waiting list, you had to get sign up on it. And it was a waiting list because back in those days, we had one or two servers and it was like 10,000 users per day after we first launched, right? So the beginning was really through a crowdfunding campaign. It was the summer of, 2014, where we said to the user community, okay, you like what we're doing. We want to keep doing it, but on my PhD, you know, grad school salary, it's not going to work, right? So, you know, please donate some money to help us grow and sustain the service. And what was amazing about that was actually 10,000 people around the world donated around $500,000 dollars to really make Proton possible. And that's always stuck with me because the reason that we exist today, the reason that we're here today is really because of the community. And you know, it wasn't, some VC, it wasn't some, you know, financial backer somewhere. It wasn't some, you know, ICO, right? It was literally people that just decided that they believed in what, you know, I believed in, they believed in this vision and they wanted to bet on it. And they had no, let's say, proof, no evidence and no guarantee of any success, right? This money that they paid up front could have just disappeared. And there's plenty of cases where people just took the money and walked off, right? So I always come to, you know, I always view this from a sense of deep gratitude, right? It's a lot of gratitude for the community for supporting us at the very beginning and getting things going. And this is why I think Proton has always put community at the heart of everything that we do, because it is because of the community that we're here today. So that's kind of the inception story of how Proton came to be, you know, back in 2014.
I love it. I mean, and you're right that path of, nuclear physicist to let's say, email service developer is not not one that's super common, perhaps. And you guys now obviously do a lot more than just email. You have a whole stack that you're building out. You have the Drive product. You have the VPN. You have the password manager. You have now this Proton wallet, a Bitcoin wallet. And I kind of want to dig into multiple aspects of that. But maybe first, can you tell me again, from my perspective, it felt like the Proton Bitcoin wallet sort of came out of the blue. Yes, of course, there's a synergy between, okay, privacy focused, you know, sovereign focused services that you guys provide and Bitcoin. Yes. But is there more to that story in terms of, you know, kind of Proton's history? What sort of led to saying, you know what, we should build a Bitcoin wallet?
Yeah. I think you touched on two interesting things there. Number one is the background of myself and the early team, you know, as scientists. It is quite unique and quite different, but I would also argue it was what was necessary for this project to even, you know, get out there in the first place. And I'll kind of give it to you, you know, from this perspective. If we had gone to, you know, business school instead of pursuing a PhD in physics, probably we wouldn't have launched the service. Because the business model in 2014, from a pure business standpoint, made no sense at all. What was the pitch, right? The pitch was, we're going to make people pay for something that the world's biggest and most dominant tech company is giving away for free. There was no investor that would back that, right? People would say that's the stupidest business plan I've ever seen because it's never going to work. So in some sense, I think being outsiders to tech, being scientists, it also made us naive enough to try something that back then was frankly insane, even though today it seems pretty you know, common sense. And this takes me back to the crowdfunding as sort of the only way to get started, because you would not find any investor that would take that business plan and say, oh yeah, that makes sense, I'm gonna bet on that. They would say, oh yeah, that's crazy, right? So the crowdfunding kicked off in June of 2014. And you know, it actually went quite well. We were surprised by how much support we had out in the community. And that was, you know, something that was incredibly, you know, that we're incredibly grateful for even today. But the crowdfunding wasn't actually smooth sailing. And what happened in July, I believe, of 2014 was actually PayPal blocked our account because they had questions. They said, oh, you know, is encryption legal? Are you allowed to encrypt emails? Do you have government permission to do what you're doing? Right, so they said, "Oh, this maybe is illegal, so we're going to block this money." So all of a sudden, we had this, you know, crowdfunding campaign that had raised hundreds of thousands of, you know, dollars, which we were going to use to basically benefit the community that has supported us and to make good on the promises that we had made. And this money was suddenly locked up, tied up someplace. We had no ability to access it, and no idea if we were ever going to get it back. And you know, there's so many people horror stories, right? You know, maybe you're locked for a day, maybe it's a week, maybe it's 2 years, maybe it's forever, right? The outcome is very, very unclear. And it was at that moment that I realized, wow, what I'm trying to do in this project, it's so fragile. It's so fragile because the financial system is so incredibly centralized, and that if you simply, you know, make someone unhappy with what you're doing, or if someone just makes a mistake, you're basically dead. And what I found interesting in that experience was that was also, well, you know, it was relatively early from a Bitcoin standpoint, right? It was a couple of years after Bitcoin had gotten started. And someone in our community said, you know what? You should start accepting Bitcoin. You should take Bitcoin donations because PayPal has blocked you. So, you know, it's easy to make an address, just open up a Bitcoin link. And we actually did that. So I actually went out there, you know, created, I forgot what website it was, but it was probably one of the, you know, OG Bitcoin, you know, wallets, right? We created a Bitcoin wallet, we put the link out there. And actually, there were significant people from the, you know, crypto community that decided to donate through Bitcoin after PayPal, you know, blocked our account. PayPal, of course, eventually unblocked the account, right? But it took them a while, it was quite slow. And in that period, we received quite a few, you know, Bitcoins. And then I'll think, you know, what is this Bitcoin thing? You know, what is this? What is going on here? Like, I don't understand this. And then I went in to dig deeper and I realized, well, okay, this is quite powerful. So like there's no central person that can block these transactions. There's, you know, nobody that can, you know, wake up one day, make a mistake and destroy your business. This is incredibly powerful. And it is one of the most, I think, powerful business concepts ever, because the issue that we faced today, even 10 years on, if Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and the big banks decided to gang up on Proton, they can still do the same thing to us today, right? So from that moment to today, I think I've always been an advocate of how can we get this powerful concept that enabled Proton to survive, 10 years ago, and make it more widespread and make it more common, because I think the future of business, democracy, freedom, it really depends on this. And so that was the reason why, in some sense, Proton Wallet has been 10 years in the making. It didn't take us 10 years to do it, but the idea of doing it has always been there. And we're fortunate in 2024 to finally be at a place in terms of organization, in terms of headcount, in terms of resources, to actually make a credible attempt to do it properly. Because there's been a lot of, let's say, improper things that have been done in Bitcoin and crypto over the past 10 years, and we didn't want to, do it the wrong way. We want to do it the right way.
I love that, and I think that's it's incredible context. Again, from the outside looking in, it seemed, oh, what a random but cool thing for Proton to be doing, building a Bitcoin wallet. In reality, Bitcoin was actually there at the genesis, so to speak, of Proton. And I mean, it's such a I have to say, I think PayPal has probably been one of the greatest inadvertent marketers for Bitcoin, in that they have shut off so many people from their services. And as a result, people looked for alternatives. And you had somebody in the community who was forward-thinking enough to say, "Hey, check out this Bitcoin thing." And you guys were open enough to say, "Yeah, we'll try anything. We're dead in the water otherwise." I think that's it's quite a beautiful little piece of serendipity there that has now brought you here to 10 years later. As you said, you're bigger. You have what is it, like 100 million users worldwide, something like that?
Proton today services 100 million accounts globally across all of our different products. So it's reached quite a big scale, I think, but it's mostly through word of mouth, which I think is quite unique about the setup. And it's word of mouth because, to be frank, we don't have the money to run tons of advertising, right? So the best advertising is people who like the service, who then bring in their friends, and that's actually the way that we have grown. And actually, when we started with encrypted email, people said, "Well, there's PGP, right?" And PGP is true; it's been there since the early '90s, late '80s, maybe. But what Proton, I think, has always excelled at, and what we're also trying to do in Proton Wallet as well, is, the problem with PGP was not that it was insecure, right? The problem with PGP was that, one click was too much. And what I think we try to do is remove the extra click and have a big focus on user experience, because unfortunately, a lot of the things that we want to do, whether it's encrypted email or even Bitcoin in general, this doesn't really go into the mainstream unless you can make the user experience equivalent to what people in the mainstream are used to. And it's a tough challenge, but I think that is like the key business problem that we as an organization are trying to solve, and not just for email and encryption, but also for crypto as well and Bitcoin.
I think that's such an important point to dig into, because a lot of people, and this is sad to say, and some people may disagree with this, they're free to, but a lot of people don't care enough about their privacy or their data security to sacrifice the user experience. They truly just will not, quote, go the extra mile, even if it is beneficial to them to do so, even if it's not, quote, that hard. They really just will not go through those extra steps because, I mean, that's what often the trade-offs we make for privacy are in favor of convenience, right? That's why people make the trade-offs, because yeah, everybody could be, using PGP or doing whatever other methods there are to keep yourself very, very secure. But most people just aren't going to do that. They just don't care enough about their privacy. They may care a little bit, but not enough to sacrifice what they view as a seamless user experience, that everything's easy, they don't have to worry about it, they don't have to learn something new. And I think that so that's really powerful, is what you guys have been able to do is make privacy easier for people, make it so that they still have that nice user experience that doesn't make them feel like they need to be a genius with cryptography to figure out how to be just, a bit more private. And I think that that's really powerful. And the same thing applies to Bitcoin as well. It's like, a lot of people, even though taking self-custody is not that hard, It's not, you know, hard to send a Bitcoin transaction even, you know, copying and pasting. But yeah, it can be daunting. I know it's, I think it's still daunting for most Bitcoiners. Did you copy and paste it right? Did you somehow type an extra word in there, whatever? But but still, anything that can be done to improve that experience, make it easier, that just lowers the bar for more and more people to come in. And it seems that's really what you guys are trying to do with Proton Wallet. So maybe we can dig into the wallet a little bit now and just kind of, can you walk me through just, you know, it's in beta right now, but kind of what is the goal with the wallet? Who are you trying to reach as a user? Obviously, you know, your existing user base, but what's kind of the methodology behind, how did you decide to build it in the way that you're building it? And what does that look like?
Yeah, I think the best way to kind of give you the context there is to start with sort of the motivation and then also the problem, right? So the way that I view it is, if I don't want to be in the situation of, you know, PayPal from 10 years ago, which can always happen to any company anytime in the future, right? Strategically, what makes the most sense is I would like to have a system where every single Proton user is on Bitcoin, and as a result, is able to pay me through Bitcoin. And in that world, I am no longer at the mercy of, you know, a centralized financial system that really doesn't have the best interests of Proton, you know, companies or even consumers at heart, right? They only have their own interests at heart, to be honest. So that's the motivation. But then the next question is, why do the vast majority, so we have, of course, a lot of Bitcoin users within Proton, but the majority of Proton users are not into Bitcoin or even more broadly crypto. And why is that? Well, I have sort of two guesses as to why that may be, right? One, if you look at crypto, and again, you know, Bitcoin and crypto are not the same thing, but let's just start with crypto in general, right? Crypto has had 10 years of bad headlines continuously. And the FTX thing, I think, you know, a while back, that didn't help either, right? Because that was really kind of a huge mess. So the average user looks at this and say, you know, I can't get involved in this because I'm going to get scammed. I'm going to lose my money. It's horrible, right? I hear all these headlines, these horror stories. The government's there telling me this is the worst thing in the world because I'm going to get scammed, and SBF is going to jail now because of whatever, right? And I think Binance and CZ recently got in trouble as well, right? So that's, I think, issue number one. Then the second issue is, if I am already a bit afraid of the space, and then I want to dip my toes into it, well, the user experience is so complicated. I don't even know where to start. I don't know how to do it. You know, what is my hash? What is my recovery? That, you know, what is my private key? It's these complicated concepts I can't figure out. It's hard. I feel like I have to study a week just to know how to get started. It's too complicated. And so those, in my mind, is sort of the main barriers to adoption. And this is the problem that we really want to solve with Proton Wallet. So let's start with the security problem, right? Fortunately, Proton does have a strong reputation of being secure, because, you know, it's not because I think we're particularly good or better than, let's say, other people at this, but we've always taken the right choices. So, you know, being open source, for example, allowing people to audit the code and verify that things are, you know, properly done. Having security at the forefront of sort of how we build things from the beginning. This has let us, let's say, do encryption well. It is something that we understand and have done for at least 10 years, right? And so we have that foundation, which I think is critically important to build off of. And we also have certain things that we have done over the past 10 years by being in the email space that gives us a lot of benefits, I think, that maybe other players within, you know, crypto and Bitcoin don't really have. And one of the things that we have is actually 100 million accounts. And you'll understand, one of the biggest issues that people have to deal with in the email space, or if you go to Google, if you go to, like, you know, Apple, you go to Microsoft, biggest problem is phishing and account takeover, right? And in reality, that's going to be one of the ways in which you're going to get your coins stolen is if someone breaks into your account because maybe they have SIM swapped your 2FA on your phone, right? And we're actually very good at preventing account takeover because that is in many ways part of our core business, which makes us unique in the crypto space. So I think the fact that we have things like Pronaut Sentinel, AI tools to look at account security, a big focus on account security, we're able to better block malicious takeover attempts of user accounts. And that gives, one pillar of security. The second pillar of security in crypto is the very famous phrase, not your keys, not your coins, right? And that's simply the notion that if you're not in control of your own encryption keys, if you're using, let's say, a custodial wallet like the likes of Binance or FTX, then actually your coins don't really belong to you. They can be taken from you. They can be stolen from you by someone that, even if FTX wasn't stealing money off the top, someone else could have hacked in and stolen that money, right? So the second pillar of our design was to couple our strong account security also with self-custody. And this is the idea that your Proton Wallet account, the keys belong fully to you. It doesn't depend on us because in fact, we don't have access to your keys. And in fact, I prefer that as well because it also makes Proton a less appealing target. There's no centralized vault somewhere holding tons of Bitcoin that someone can break in and steal, right? It's a decentralized in a self-custody way. And so that's, I think, the second pillar of the security standpoint. And we also did something that was a little bit controversial, but we also came out Bitcoin only at the very beginning. And the reason for this, there's many reasons for it, right? But at the end of the day, part of the reason I think crypto in general has such a bad reputation is that millions of people have lost billions, getting scammed, doing all sorts of stuff, right? So I think also being Bitcoin only at the beginning, this sort of reduces the risk of users coming in and actually losing substantial sums of money on things that maybe are not kosher. So I think that's sort of how we look at it from a security standpoint. And there, the fact that we are also open source, the fact that we're also based in Switzerland under Swiss legislation, the fact that everything that we do is publicly audited, the fact that there's Proton's 10-year track record, and also the fact that we're not a crypto or Bitcoin company. We're not in the trading business. We're not doing staking. We're not investing. We're not gambling. We don't have an ICO. We don't have some random coin that we've made that we're hawking and trying to make profit off of. Our business is security and privacy, and that's it. So that's, I think, the things that make us different from the security standpoint. And then of course there's all the stuff around user experience, but this is why it took 10 years. And I think this is why our approach is a little bit different. It's not totally unique in the space, but it's rare to have all those elements together. You can find maybe two or three elements together in one place, but to find them all in one offering, I think that's maybe where we can make a difference from a security standpoint.
The great thing about Bitcoin is it does not matter if you are a nuclear physicist at CERN or a tech illiterate boomer or somewhere in between. You can still keep your Bitcoin safe for the long haul when you have an easy to use hardware wallet like the Bitbox O2. Go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker to get yourself 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet or anything else in their store. Then, of course, get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. I have really enjoyed working with the Bitbox team and their support of the show. They're an awesome group of people, and they build easy-to-use, secure, open-source solutions to keep your Bitcoin safe. And not only is the Bitcoin in your Bitbox safe from government confiscation, let's say, but Bitbox is one of the only two wallets to actually address the dark Skippy vulnerability. So you're in luck if you have one. And if you don't, you can go to their website and get 5% off right now. And I cannot emphasize this enough, but the Bitbox O2 is truly easy as hell to use, whether you are brand new to Bitcoin, it's your very first time setting up a hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath. It is Bitcoin only, and once again, it is fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. There's no need to trust me or BitBox. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you. I really appreciate the explanation on the why Bitcoin only as well, because that was when, you know, I posted this on Nostr and on X, just that I would be interviewing you and got some questions, and some of them were from folks in the, you know, the crypto crowd, in quotation marks. And one of the things was, well, you know, when is there going to be support for the other, you know, the other cryptocurrencies? And I think that something that folks who are focused on solely Bitcoin, like myself and like Croton, is there's a recognition that, look, yes, some of these other things are there may be some neat little use cases that you've developed, but ultimately they are not built on a solid foundation. It's a castle built on sand versus a castle built on solid bedrock. And using any of these inferior products, I think one of the points that you mentioned that's so crucial is one of the reasons Bitcoin gets such a bad reputation often, I think a lot of this is changing, but it has certainly, is because it is lumped in with all of crypto, all of the scams. People hear Bitcoin, and many of them who don't know any better think SBF was, you know, somehow in charge, you know, the CEO of Bitcoin or something. Yeah. And so all of these scams, these bad headlines, all these pre-mines, all these ICOs, they all get lumped in and tarnish that reputation of Bitcoin, which is in fact separate and different. And so I really applaud and appreciate the fact that you guys said, nope, we're going to go Bitcoin only. Bitcoin is the choice here. And why focus on an inferior coin that also is not as, neither as decentralized nor as secure, nor as fair as Bitcoin. So I think that's great. And one thing I want to dig into a little bit with you here is, you know, you said, okay, Proton's not necessarily doing anything super, super new. But I think in one way that you guys really do seem to be innovating is this idea of sending Bitcoin to an email address. And sure, on the Lightning Network, you can have like your Lightning address. I know, I think maybe it was a little over a year ago, Michael Saylor announced that MicroStrategy was converting their corporate email addresses to Lightning addresses as well. So you have anyone's corporate email, you can also send them a Lightning payment. That's an incredible piece of interoperability. Lightning addresses are a really wonderful improvement to user experience built on top of LNURL. But you guys are talking about base chain Bitcoin being sent to an email address. Can we get into that a little bit of kind of how that works, if this is a good time for that? And just because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think anyone else has done that in terms of actually having the email address be your ability to receive it. And then maybe we could talk a little bit about, okay, are you guys generating a new receive address for each time a transaction comes, just from a privacy perspective? Can we dig into that a little bit, just how that works and how you guys approached it?
Yeah, happy to jump into that. But actually, I wanted to go back a little bit to the Bitcoin only, comment.
Oh, please, right? Please.
And just add a bit of you know color there, right? It's not that Proton as a company is, you know, religiously, you know, against any other coin, right? It's not that we want to just go out there and say, oh, you know, everything out there is shit coins. It's, you know, that's not, let's say, our statement. The statement actually that when we look at this is a little bit more, nuanced. And what it is the analogy I would give is going back to, you know, email, right? When we started email in 2014. If you told me in 2014 to build the world's most secure, you know, communication system, the answer would not have been email. I would have built a Signal or something else, right? But what was critical is the network. And email, because it is federated, which means that anybody can run their own email server and talk to the network, you know, as they wish, it's not closed or owned by anybody. That actually has made it the most successful communication system that humans have ever devised, right? Everybody's got it, it's the most ubiquitous, it's the most common, and it will always be there to stay, despite 30 years of people saying email is dead. It's not dead, right? Even after 30 years. So from that perspective, email wasn't, let's say, the best technical choice, but it was the only choice if it really wanted to have an impact. right? So your option could be to build something new that maybe would not get widespread adoption, or you could take the thing that was already widely adopted and make it more secure. And yeah, I kind of view the choice of Bitcoin as well from a similar lens. If you told me today, with all of hindsight and all the information that we've learned in the past, 10 years or more, to build the most secure and private cryptocurrency, the code probably wouldn't be the Bitcoin code that is running today on Bitcoin Core, right? It's probably something different. You know, maybe it might even be Monero or something along those lines, right? But the network is very important. So if our goal is to have freedom of transaction and financial sovereignty and freedom, we have two choices, right? It's a kind of like with email, and the logical choice should be to go to the biggest network and make that more secure and more private, as opposed to building new networks which may not have a critical mass and may not get the network effect. And who knows, right? It's very possible that someday something new comes out that displaces SMTP and email. Something new could also come out someday and displace Bitcoin. And if that happens, we're very happy to adapt and change and do things differently. But I do believe very strongly in focus, right? You want to do things well. And from a business perspective, actually supporting all the possible coins out there is better for business because it means more potential users, right? But it will also probably mean a less good product because you're just spread too thin. You're not focusing on the main use case. And I think that's probably a good segue into, talking about Bitcoin via email, which is sort of the feature, right? It's
yeah. Absolutely. Because
of course, on security, actually, it's possible for someone to do all the things that we've done right on security and replicate that. The reason I think the Bitcoin via email feature is a little bit different is because there has not really been any company that has decided to go into Bitcoin that also happens to be an email company. Because quite frankly, there are not that many email companies out there to begin with, right? Most of them have actually been killed off in the last 20 years by Google and other tech giants. So what we sort of realized is the main pain point. If I wanted to send Bitcoin to my mother, and actually my mother is sort of the target audience, right? That's a level of sophistication that we want to be able to build for, right? If you ask her to, take a really long hexadecimal string, exchange it with somebody else out of band, check each character one by one to make sure it's okay, and then do that again for every single transaction, because if you use the same thing over and over again, it's not private, right? And to keep the address that she has exchanged with every single person clear in her head, it's simply too much to ask for, right? I have to run, did I give this address to this person, to that person? If I receive money in this address, who paid me? I see a string, but I don't know who it was, right? It's endlessly complicated. It simply doesn't work. And what we realize is sending money in some sense, sending value, it's actually not too different from sending email. Why? Because when you send email, you want to make sure the person that received the message is actually the right person. You need to have a verification there involved. So we were sort of in a unique position given our knowledge of encryption and given our knowledge of of Bitcoin from 10 years ago, plus the fact that we are a pretty significant email provider, to actually combine the two. And we make fun of PayPal a bit at the beginning, right? But PayPal is actually an amazing product.
Yeah.
With just an email address, you can send money, and it could be any currency, to anybody in the world. I mean, that is objectively incredible, right?
As long as they're not in a blacklisted country, let's say.
Yes, exactly, right? As long as their account's not locked, et cetera, right?
So, but fair, it is amazing.
Yeah. So what if you could do that, but still preserve the properties of Bitcoin, which is the fact that no one can lock your funds, your money is your money, and it's decentralized, and it's not controlled by any central entity. So that was really the big vision and the big dream. And with Proton Wallet, actually, we could disappear tomorrow. And just vanish off the face of the earth, and you would still have your coins, right? As long as you kept your recovery seed phase, that still belongs to you. So what we do is we take the Bitcoin address and we really associate it with the email system, because email encryption also is an exchange of keys, just like transacting with Bitcoin. And what that basically means is if I want to send you Bitcoin, all I have to do is I just need to know your email address. I can type in your email address, type in the number of coins I want to send you, click send, and it's done. And that, I think, is probably, you know, a quantum, you know, leap in terms of user experience compared to what has existed in the past. And we put a lot of effort into making that also private, right? So if I send you, you know, Bitcoin by email, if someone else does it, well, that someone else is going to see a different address because we automatically pre-generate and rotate the addresses for you. So, you know, the thing of keeping the addresses straight, this issue is solved, right? And because it's Bitcoin via email, when you receive money, you actually know who sent it to you. And I think what is also the most powerful element of this is I don't even need to have been previously in touch with you and have an open communication channel with you in order to transact with you. I just simply need to know, you know, your email address, which maybe you have posted, you know, on your Twitter account or something like that, right? And if you post your Bitcoin address here, well, that's not very private because everybody sees it and everybody, you know, goes to the same address. So actually, you address that issue as well. And this is why I think it's a pretty significant, you know, innovation from a user experience standpoint. But what it also can do is it can solve one of the problems of scale. You know, today, there are some estimates that say there's probably 500 million crypto users overall, right? Of which probably most of them are Bitcoin, I would suspect. But with Proton Wallet, what we can actually do is we can add a Bitcoin wallet into every single Proton account. So overnight, you can actually go from, you know, you can add 100 million to that existing 500 million, and that's an appreciable increase. And let's say anybody new to the space, you know, would like to participate and join the network. Well, it's now as simple as creating a Proton account. And every single month, there are millions of people who create a Proton account because maybe they want the email, maybe they want the VPN, maybe they want the file storage, maybe they want the password manager. All these people that enter our ecosystem are now also, you know, going to be added into the Bitcoin ecosystem. So I think that ease of use combined with the scale has a multiplying effect, which can actually, you know, in the long run, significantly increase adoption. It'll take some time, but I think that's potential. And this is why we thought, okay, we're sort of in a unique position to address our core issue with, you know, PayPal money being blocked and, you know, not feeling very secure with digital finance, but also really open up the space more broadly. And this is really the vision, and this is why we built it the way that we built it.
It's fascinating, first of all. And one of the pieces that you mentioned about just that out-of-band communication, I think is so vital because you're right. You know, okay, you've got the freedom to transact, right, with Bitcoin. Great. You cannot be censored from completing a transaction. But you need to coordinate to make that transaction. You need some sort of secure way to ensure that the person you're communicating with is actually the person you intend to send the money to, that they're not somehow being spoofed. And you need to make sure that those messages are not somehow being altered along the way, that there's not a new address being inserted into your communication somehow, because if you're using some centralized provider and, you know, some big brother or company is watching, well, then you don't actually have certainty that you are, in fact, communicating with who you're communicating with. But this provides that parallel channel, I think. And I would say that, you know, the freedom to, this is ultimately free speech, right? The freedom to communicate, that has to go hand in hand with the freedom to transact, or it becomes far less powerful. And so I think that that's beautiful. And thank you for addressing the address part as well, because I know one of the big things I've seen as pushback on Proton has been, well, you're associating an email address with a Bitcoin address. That's the worst thing ever for privacy, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, this is, you guys are basically automating, improving the user experience of not having address reuse, which if anyone, you know, anybody who's deep into Bitcoin will tell you, address reuse is the worst thing you can do for your privacy, right? Because then it becomes trivially simple to be able to associate that, maybe not with you potentially, but with that persona, to at least say, yes, these, you know, these UTXOs all belong to whoever this individual is. And then maybe there's other ways that you can figure out actually the real world identity of that individual. Yeah, so again, for anyone listening, there are no address reuse. You're generating a new receive address, and I think that that's really really powerful. I'm curious what other pushback you guys have seen on this? Is that the biggest one of kind of privacy, with the assumption that you're associating a single Bitcoin receive address with a, you know, single email? So how can that be good? Or yes, are there other things you guys see a lot?
Well, actually, there's actually maybe a bit more context I can add to that, right?
Sure, that'd be great.
With a Proton account, if you have a paid account, for example, you can actually generate multiple email addresses. So you could actually create a new address not associated with your, you know, regular address you're using to correspond, in order to use just for, you know, Bitcoin via email, right? This is a possibility. But also, Bitcoin via email is not mandatory. It's actually an optional feature. So you could just opt out of it and say, you know, I don't want this on my account. I want to do it the old-fashioned way. And that may, so basically you retain the choice of kind of how you want to set it up. And I believe in letting users have the choice, because everybody's threat model is different, right? You know, for some people, and I would say for most people, having an easy way to verify who you're sending money to is probably more important than ensuring that, you know, you're completely anonymous and no one can track you and whatever, right? But because things are optional, you have both choices, right? You can use it the way that you want, depending on what problem, you know, you need to actually solve. So I think even in the early days of Proton Mail, and even to Proton Wallet, there will always be, you know, people who are, let's say, more absolute in their views of privacy, who will say, oh, you know, this is not as secure, right? And, you know, when we did email in the beginning, yes, you could, for example, use a one-time pad, and that would be objectively more secure, but it has a user experience problem associated with that. And what I kind of, you know, responded to people that were complaining about, you know, Proton Mail back 10 years ago was, you know what? Yes, you're an expert PGP user, and that's good, but you're not actually, you know, my target audience, not because I don't care about you, I do, right? But actually because you're not the one that most needs our help, right? You know, our mission is to actually get the other 99.9% that without better technology to make it easier to use, simply will not have the option to have the benefits that you have because you're tech savvy. And so it's similar, I think, in Proton Wallet, is that for the ones who are hardcore Bitcoiners that, you know how things work, have their paper wallets or their, you know, metal wallets etched and buried in the backyard somewhere, it's we would love to get you as a user, actually, because I believe the ease of use benefits are still good for you, but you're not really the ones that need help, right? It's everybody else that actually needs help. Coming back to the question of the biggest pushback was probably from the non-Bitcoin crowd that was quite frustrated that we were not adding support for, you know, their favorite coin, whichever it is. And there are 100 variants of this, right? And I get it, right? It's a financial decision for a lot of people. A lot of people are heavily invested into these coins. And of course, having them integrated in the Proton ecosystem, having the potential to have their favorite coin, you know, gain 100 million users over the next, you know, year, that probably would have been good for whatever coin they were deeply invested in, right? But it's a resource thing. I simply cannot support every single coin out there. It's a lot of resources to do one coin well. And what you also have to remember is most of the people in the Proton ecosystem, they're there because they trust us. And if I were to propose, you know, any of these hundreds of coins, and you know, someone were to buy that and you know, get wiped out because it was a rug pull, it was a scam, it was whatever, ultimately you could say it's not Proton's fault, right? But the user won't view it that way. The user is going to blame it on us. So I think it needs to be highly selective, you know, curated list. I think recently there's been some price dips in Bitcoin recently as well, right? And even then we had user complaints, hey, you know, you promoted this thing on us, and then, you know, I lost some money. Are you going to compensate me for that, right? So you know, that's always a risk that we have to think about as well, and which is why I think let's do the Bitcoin wallet very well, right? You know, and I think it has potential to become the best Bitcoin wallet out there. And then when we reach that point, then let's discuss about other things, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, I'm kind of curious as well, because this, so, you know, you mentioned that you guys are open source. I assume the Proton wallet will also be open source.
Yes.
So are you guys thinking at all about interoperability in terms of, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, there aren't too many email providers these days. The number dwindles and consolidates. But is that something you guys are thinking about at all in terms of, okay, I want to be able to, you know, have this spec be able to be implemented by others. Whether or not they would is a different story, but just theoretically, somebody like Gmail, say, wants to implement the spec to be able to say, okay, you can, you know, now use your Gmail address as a receive address. Are you guys thinking about that at all, or is it too kind of early stage for that?
I don't think it requires a spec, actually, right? Because because Bitcoin is already very open. Email is already very open. We didn't go to IETF and get an RFC to standardize everything, but it is public, kind of what we do and how we do it. And I think anybody that wanted to could build on top of that and build something compatible with that, right? So if there is, let's say, broader interest from the broader tech community in standardizing this, this is something we could take to IETF, we could start to standardize it. But yeah, I don't really quite see, you know, the big mainstream email providers jumping into this space going in this direction. It's not aligned with their business model, right? You know, they're not really for privacy or anonymity because that's not profitable for them, right? Maybe someday a program gets so successful and has so many users, they're forced to do it to compete with this and to have feature parity, maybe, right? But that's probably quite far down the road. So it is possible. But we're not actively going out there and trying to say, you know, convince Gmail to adopt this. It didn't seem like it would be a good use of our time right now. And I think it'd be kind of an uphill battle.
I think that's a fair assessment. And just speaking of Gmail and kind of these other, Microsoft, the other behemoths out there. I mean, because you guys, it really is like a David versus multiple Goliaths in this case. Yes. And only a few Goliaths left. But I'd love to talk a little bit about just your deeper ethos, both you, but then also Proton as an organization, because I think, again, for a lot of people, the freemium model was very popular for a while. Like, oh, great, this service is free. You know, if an app cost money on the app store, it's like, well, I'm not going to do that. I can just get a free app. People expected software, they expected applications, they expected services to be free, because that was the model for so long that was pervasive, not realizing that there is no such thing as a free lunch that in fact, they're not the user, they're the product, they're not the customer, I should say. They are the user, but they're not the customer. How, you know, you guys have obviously been very successful with a model of, we built something that we are going to charge you money for because we're not going to scrape your data. Was that really always kind of the plan? What is the ethos behind Proton? How do you guys think about this, and how does that compare to the free but not really free other options that are out there for people?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, right? You know, nothing is actually free. So, you know, when you get Google for free, it's not free. You're paying me the most intimate, sensitive, and important information, right? And it's kind of, as you say, yes, you're Google's user, but you're the product being sold to the actual customer, which is the advertiser. And so I view it philosophically from a perspective of alignment of interest. Because our interests as a company, and now even as a nonprofit, has to be aligned with the interests of the customer. And in Google's business, there is no such alignment. It's some weird bargain where it's like, I hope you don't read my terms and conditions and realize the horrible things I'm doing, and I'm going to exploit your data to, you know, satisfy my real customers and abuse your privacy, you know, as a user. It's a shitty bargain. It's a shitty deal. And I like sort of a more honest and a more straightforward business model. People pay Proton for one reason, because protect their privacy. And that's also very important the other way around, because you're paying us to protect your privacy, my only incentive is to keep protecting your privacy, right? The instant I do something else, I've actually destroyed my whole business. So even if you didn't trust me and you instead trusted capitalism, I'm actually financially incentivized to protect your privacy. And that, I think, is the strongest alignment that you can actually, you know, obtain in business. And that is stable. That's something that can persist and last for a long time. And there's you know, longevity to that. So I think that is the alignment of interest that I find to be fundamental to, you know, everything else, right? But then beyond that, there's also, you know, company culture. And culture really comes a lot of times, not just from the founders, but also from the early employees and from the early team. And company culture, in many ways, is, you know, who you hire, fire, and promote, right? And I would say we at Proton have a really unique culture because most of us that started this, you know, project, we didn't do it for the money, right? You know, we did it because we truly believed in the mission. And that's a very scientific thing. You know, no one goes to science for money. They do it because you believe in the challenge, you believe in the problem that you're solving, and you think it'll benefit mankind. So, and then that culture sort of persists over time because the ones that you will bring in and hire and bring onto your staff, well, they tend to think in the same way. You know, also because we're not going to, you know, try to offer the highest salaries in the market. We're not going to compete with Google. It's not really possible to compete on a cash basis, right? So if people come to join Proton, and a lot of them, in fact, have come from Google and these big tech companies, right? Generally, they're not taking, well, we're not saying take a massive pay cut, but they do take a bit of a pay cut, at least on a cash perspective, to come here. And that's also a self-selection process. It means you're selecting the people that fundamentally value a bit moral and ethics and what is right versus wrong, as opposed to profit. And that allows you to perpetuate that, you know, within your business over time. And that's also kind of why Google has gone wrong, because people that have a strong moral compass, they're not going to join a company that doesn't have any sense of morals, doesn't have sense of right or wrong, right? So Google actually over time will tend to attract the more mercenary personalities who are profit at, you know, at any cost, at all costs. And you see how that kind of culture has evolved the business over the past 20 years from, you know, do no evil to do any evil as long as it's profitable, right? So it's also a divergence in culture. And at Proton, what we've done in the past, you know, couple of months is we formalized that through actually, you know, structuring it as a nonprofit now. So, you know, having the nonprofit, you know, be the main shareholder of the company, it takes what was already more or less true, but it makes it now legally binding, which is, you know, it's not really an assurance that I really felt, you know, I needed because I was confident in our direction and our culture. But I think for the broader community as a whole, it's a way of saying, you know, Proton is making a lasting legal commitment to respect these values over the long term. And I think that was why it was a very important move to do. It wasn't, easy to do, but it was far easier to do it at Proton than say at a place like Google, right? And so I'm glad we did it, you know, in the end.
And it's a perfect transition there, because that was literally the next thing I wanted to ask you about. Was that's a really interesting move. I mean, you're obviously have a massive user base. Again, we're talking 100 million plus users. I'm assuming several hundred employees. I mean, a pretty big operation. And global, a lot of people would look at this and say, well, okay, the next step is obviously we've got to take this thing public. Maybe we've got to, you know, raise a few funding rounds. I think you said initially you didn't take any VC money at all. Is that correct?
Yeah, Proton doesn't have any VC investors today. Oh. So it's not a venture backed company like, you know, most of the companies out there.
Which is quite rare for a technology company these days. I mean, it's really rare. And Can you talk about, I mean, so because I'm curious, the structure of the nonprofit. So is it an outside nonprofit that then came in and is the majority shareholder, or was a new nonprofit created kind of out of Proton, which now has that controlling interest? How does that work?
Yeah, it was created out of Proton.
Okay.
You know, there were no, you know, controlling outside shareholders to involve in the process. So basically it was, you know, myself, the founding team, essentially, who made the decision that actually, you know, we want to preserve Proton values over the long term, right? And, you know, we didn't get in the business to make money at the beginning. So, you know, we're not, say, waiting on an IPO or some big trade sale later on down the road to, you know, get rich and retire or vote somewhere, right? Some people, for them, that's important, but it wasn't, let's say, the main focus here. So we set up the structure in this way because foundations are permanent. You know, people can leave, people can die, people can, you know, things happen, right? But a foundation with a legally binding bylaw, that actually perpetuates over time. And that gives long-term certainty. And I think this is kind of important because in the privacy space, we've seen companies, you know, get shut down. We've seen companies get bought by others who had different sets of morals and values. You know, I think you mentioned you use ExpressVPN, right? You know, ExpressVPN was bought some time ago by, you know, a new company, which some people, you know, didn't trust in the same way as the previous company, right? You know, and these things can happen in business. This is part of business, part of life. And I think what our structure does is it prevents that. It ensures that Proton remains independent and focused on our mission over the long term. And that's, I think, an important guarantee that we need to make to the community. And it is a bit unique. Now, there's an interesting kind of, you know, dichotomy here, right? Because nonprofits can also go wrong. So if you look broadly at the world of nonprofits today, you have things like Signal, Mozilla, Tor. In fact, there's plenty of nonprofits. And so I don't actually believe that Proton, even though we're structured today with a nonprofit as, you know, the controlling shareholder, we should not actually forget about profit. In fact, I think it's very important for us to keep profits, you know, at the center. And I'll give kind of an example here. You know, I've actually got a lot of respect for the folks at, you know, Mozilla, but it's not a secret. Mozilla's today's main source of funding is from Google, the same company that is its main competitor and is trying to kill privacy globally, right? If you look at Tor, a big chunk of their funding comes from the U.S. State Department, comes from government, right? And there's also plenty of, nonprofits out there that are, donation-based, which is not really sustainable and may make you make compromises that in the end, you know, don't give, let's say, certainty that you'll be around 10, 20, 30, you know, 100 years from now. So what is interesting about Proton's nonprofit structure is at the heart of a nonprofit is actually a profitable company. It seems like a paradox, but actually it's not, because it's the best way to self-reinforce the nonprofit structure, right? Because the heart and the core asset of our nonprofit is a profitable company, that is the tool that gives the nonprofit the independence that it needs to safeguard the mission overall. So people, you know, they say, oh, it's a paradox, it doesn't make any sense, but actually it's a self-reinforcing, and it's not a paradox, it's actually completely aligned. So transitioning to the structure doesn't mean that, you know, we don't care about profit. Actually, we need to probably care even more about profit, because that is the thing that will ensure the long-term independence of the Proton Foundation. It's a bit of a paradox, it's a bit confusing, but if you think it through, it actually makes, you know, perfect sense. And it also makes sense because we're trying to take on the Googles of the world, who have hundreds of billions in cash. And even if they're completely wrong for their vision of the internet, even if the average person out there in the street doesn't agree with what they are doing and agrees more with our vision, in the end, money matters, resources matter. So we do need to also be able to match that. I think we can be a lot smarter, a lot more efficient, a lot more, you know, agile, and we can frankly also work a lot harder than they can, right, to close the gap. But you're not going to close a $100 billion gap this way, right? You also need probably billions on your own to do that as well. So profits is another vehicle in which we drive change. And this is why Proton continues to have a very strong business focus, a very strong business mindset. Because without that, I don't think our mission works. So it seems a little bit like a paradox, but it's actually self-reinforcing and consistent, you know, once you think it through.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. I wasn't exactly sure where you were going with it at first, but this made a lot more sense. Now, it's essentially the idea, it goes back to the incentives you talked about. The incentive to deliver, like, you are selling a privacy service to your customers. Your incentive is to deliver that privacy service. because then you will retain and grow your customer base. If you want to be able to do that independent of, let's say, State Department funding or funding from Google, well, you need to be profitable. You need to be delivering that best service to your customers, and that delivering that best service is what allows you to remain independent because it allows you to be the most profitable. So I think it's perfectly consistent there. And I'm curious because I saw a couple of people in the comments make mention of Proton used to have some World Economic Forum members on their board, and I wanted to bring this up because full disclosure, I did not go down a deep rabbit hole or anything like that. But I saw people bring this up, and so clearly it's a concern some folks have. They see World Economic Forum, and they many times very fair reasons get a little bit leery. Can you address that at all, just so we can kind of maybe put some of these things to bed? Or what's the let's talk about it.
Yeah, of course. So actually, World Economic Forum is based in Geneva, which is where we're based. You know, okay. Yep. I guess that's more fodder for the conspiracy theorists, but you know, let's put it out there, right? So everybody knows. And you know, I've been to actually a few of their events just out of curiosity, right? You know, I'm not a member or anything because I can't afford to be a member. It costs too much, right? And look, they're not. Yeah, if there's some global conspiracy, you know, around WEF, I can tell you this. They're not anywhere near organized enough or effective enough, you know, for that to be the case, right? So no, Proton is not affiliated with WEF. I'm not a member of WEF, right? You know, we did win one of their startup prizes some years ago, right? But you know, we're not a member, we're not a card game member, we don't pay any dues. And yes, there is, I think people mentioned there was one, board member at the corporation level, not the foundation level, right? Who formerly was part of some, you know, chaired some committee or working group there, right? But this is formerly, and it's not there anymore. So people said, there was, your website was changed, right? But actually, you know, if someone changes their role and is not involved somewhere anymore, then you make a change there. So it's a no. There's no lizard people, you know, sitting behind this curtain controlling Proton. It's not how it works.
I appreciate the context there because again, I wanted to ask it because I think it's always better to put these things put these out in the open. And so I appreciate the candid response there. Mm-hmm. And Javier Milei went and spoke at the World Economic Forum, so yeah. I don't think he's a lizard person, but they may have. Yeah. I think who knows? They may have a few of them back there. Who can say? But I don't think that curtain looks too small to hide any today. I appreciate it.
The thing is, like, you know, they have such a bad reputation because they never refuted, you know, the issue. And actually, you know, WEF it represents what a lot of people don't like. Right, it represents the establishment. It represents, you know, big government, big business, and rightfully so because it's mostly funded by these giant corporations. So I think they get a lot of criticism, from what I've seen, maybe I wasn't allowed into the inner part, so maybe I don't know, right? Maybe something else going on there, but yeah, I didn't find. I don't think they're nearly as organized to be, you know, as let's say, it's not a secret thing where they're controlling, pulling the strings behind the scenes. I didn't get the sense, but of course we have no affiliation with them. Right? You know, quite frankly, for the fees that they would want to be part of that, we will probably better invest that money elsewhere, let's say.
I think that's a very fair statement.
Yeah.
So a little gear switch, just something kind of off topic, but I noticed that both Proton Mail and Proton Wallet had Nostr NPubs. They were on Nostr, I think, for a decent amount of time now. Was that something where you guys just, you know, a couple people within the organization saw Nostr, saw this traction happening and thought, okay, this is, you know, this is something we should take a look at? Are there any plans in the future, I guess? Do you see any part of the Nostr protocol that can be used in conjunction with Proton's own tech stack? Or for now, is it just a way of kind of another means of distributing information?
Yeah, I think there's a tech question and then there's the, you know, the community question, right? We're here to serve the community because in the end, the community is the only stakeholders that matter to Proton. You know, there's no external investors, it's just the community, right? And now with the nonprofit, the community literally is the stakeholder, right? It's the social benefit of the role that that we're here to serve. And what that means is we will go where our community is. So there was a time when they were on Mastodon, and we went there as well. You know, if they're on Noster, we'll go there as well. If there's something new that comes up 5 years from now, we'll go there as well. You know, now, unfortunately, a lot of them are on TikTok, right? So probably we have to go there too. Who knows, right? But our mission is to communicate, to educate, and to serve the people. And we are where the people are. This is all there is to it. Now, the technical question is very interesting. And that's where I put my engineer hat on, my scientist hat on, right? I think there's always a problem that you want to solve for the product. It's a user pain point of some sort. And you know, many years ago, people asked us, "Oh, you know, why don't you do decentralized email and run email on blockchain and do storage on on Filecoin or whatever?" Yeah. I mean, there's tons of these things in the past, right? It would be in keeping with Proton's DNA of being independent from any central control. If it's Proton, go and do it. And my response is always, what is the problem that I'm trying to solve for the customer? And what is the technical requirement that comes from that problem? And what is the best technology to solve it? And in the case of storage, I can tell you the best technology wasn't Filecoin, right? There were much better ways and by better, I mean, more cost-effective, more efficient, more reliable, faster to build ways of providing secure storage to Proton customers. Because why? The fact that, the storage is centralized is not the main issue for reliability, right? The fact that you hold your own keys and I don't have a central keychain of all your keys, that's actually the main security benefit. So it doesn't have to go on Filecoin in order for you to have the benefits of security and privacy that we promised, right? So if there is a situation where Noster protocol is technically the best solution, then we will adopt it. But it has to win on its technical merits. It cannot be ideological. It cannot be, a brand, it cannot be a fad or a trend. There's a time when putting Bitcoin or crypto or something in your pitch made your company twice as valuable, right? But and then that went away very quickly. Nowadays is AI. AI makes everything, better apparently, right? But no, I think only when it's the best technical solution. And if you take it from a long-term view, and Proton is not in the business to, chase fads, our main owner is a nonprofit, doesn't have a timeline where it needs to exit, right? In fact, the whole point is never exit. We don't need to chase fads. We just need to chase what is technically the best solution. And this is consistently what we do, all the time.
A fair response. You have to lead with what is the pain point that you are trying to solve for. Yeah. Otherwise, you end up kind of spinning your wheels and building something that maybe isn't really necessary.
Yes, yes. It was like when crypto came out, I would say 9 out of 10 things that were being built on these random blockchains probably could have been built better off the blockchain, right?
Yeah.
But they did it because it was, you could scam people out of the money more easily this way, right? So this is why they did it. It was definitely not technically the best solution. And a lot of these projects are starting to pivot now. And I think to myself, what a massive waste of capital. If they had raised that money legitimately in a different way, didn't bother with the blockchain stuff and did it in the best technical way, they'd be so much further along the roadmap by now. I think it's a mistake to get caught up in different tech trends and different tech fads.
Yeah, agreed. And I think the number of things that could have probably been done more efficiently in a centralized database versus crypto might be closer to 999 out of 1,000. Yes. But yeah,
yes.
Just given the sheer volume of tokens there are now. Speaking of roadmaps, though, just for Proton, one of the other questions that I got a few times was about Lightning network integration for the Proton wallet. And obviously, there are some major hurdles. You mentioned that user experience is really at the forefront for you guys. How are you guys thinking about any potential future Lightning implementations? Is this something that you guys are looking at right now? Is it something that you're kind of, it's a wait and see sort of thing? Because presumably people will keep asking about it. Obviously, the Lightning Network has a ton of benefits, and trade-offs, obviously. But it also has a lot of difficulties as far as running a self-custodial option. You can also use a LSPs and things like that. But how are you guys thinking about the Lightning Network? Is it on your radar, I guess, would be the first question.
Well, it's for sure on the radar. We like the idea. And why? You know, the biggest problem in Bitcoin is transaction costs too high, right? And also too slow, because the speed is also a factor. So, you know, if you can bring transaction costs down to essentially, you know, nothing with instantaneous, you know, settlement, then the potential use case of Bitcoin network, you know, multiplies exponentially, right? It can now be a means of settlement as opposed to just, you know, a means of investment or store value or whatever people use it for. So we want to do Lightning. It's definitely something that we're keen to do, but there's then the trade-offs again. You know, we talked about the pillars of security, and self-custody was one of those main pillars that you know, we felt very strongly about. Today, if you want to use Lightning, the main user benefit, let's say, you know, okay, this is generalizing a bit, but the main user benefit is actually lower transaction fees. But if you're forced to open and close and set up your own channels because you're, you know, because you're self-custody, actually, you don't really gain that benefit, right? That benefit is a lot smaller. So actually, self-custody and lower transaction fees in Lightning, they are unfortunately today a little bit, you know, mutually exclusive. And there are plenty of smart people, probably far smarter than me, right, who are spending a lot of time thinking about this and still thinking about it. And they'll probably eventually crack it, but we're not quite there yet. And Proton, because of our big focus on security, privacy, but also, and, you know, a big part of security is actually, you know, reliability, stability, resilience, right? We're never going to be actually the first adopters. And you also shouldn't want us to be the first adopters, because that actually goes against, you know, the ethos of Proton, of a security. In fact, if you think about, you know, Bitcoin in general, we got to Bitcoin later than BlackRock, right? Which is kind of insane if you think about it. But that's sort of our mindset, right? We want things to be secure, stable, resilient, reliable, and safe. And that usually doesn't mean you know, being the first to run into a space. So I think I'm confident that one day we will get, you know, self-custody Lightning and user experience problem solved. But we don't necessarily want to be the pioneers, to be the first to do that, because the first that do that are going to make a lot of mistakes, right? And, you know, we tend to like to let things mature a little bit. And I think, you know, there's been other things in Bitcoin as well specifically that are kind of at the forefront, not just Lightning. People have asked us, oh, you know, how do you implement X, Y, and Z? And my answer is, well, it's not even merging the Bitcoin core, so how can you expect me to support it, right? You know, it's simply too risky. There's bugs, and we don't want users to lose money. So we'll get there, but it's a tough one. And Lightning, I think it's unfortunately, okay, I'm gonna get some flack for this, but I think it's just not ready for prime time, you know, yet. But it's getting there.
Oh yeah, and I think that's a fair response. And you know, the way I look at Lightning is because I've set up multiple Lightning nodes using different implementations. I've tried, I mean, literally dozens of different Lightning wallets. And the reality of the situation is that a custodial Lightning wallet is far superior from an ease of use perspective. It's just the reality. When somebody else is handling all of that for you and they have big fat channels open with all of the other providers, your experience is great. You can send large amounts. You don't have to worry about channel opening and closing, and the payments always go through. The payments don't fail. And yes, you know, a lot of people, you know, custodial Lightning is a shitcoin. It's like, well, again, everything has trade-offs, right? Everything has trade-offs. And personally, I'm willing to keep a couple, you know, a few sats in a custodial Lightning wallet because it's a trade-off for convenience. And that's a trade-off I'm willing to make. I'm not putting any life savings in there, certainly. And it's the same things with, you know, other layer two or three type solutions like Federated eCash, where yes, you could get rugged by the Mint, right? You know, or Cashew, you can get rugged by the Mint. Federation or Federated eCash get rugged by the Federation. But again, there are trade-offs. You're trading off with eCash near perfect or perfect privacy for the potential to be rugged. And again, that's the beauty of Bitcoin, is that it can be built in these layers. Nobody can rug you on the base layer. That's the beauty of it, right? And so that's the place to start. But I think what's nice about the way you guys are positioned and kind of not trying to be the early adopters is you will benefit from all the incredible development that is going on right now and will be, you know, be tested thoroughly over the coming years and can kind of pick and choose to say, here's what makes the most sense for our users. Like something like a paywall that you need to spend Bitcoin to be able to send an email to somebody seems like a potential future implementation that you could do very nicely with, you know, with Lightning or with eCash, but you need to have the tools in place to be able to do it so that it aligns with how you guys, with your ethos, basically.
Yeah, but, and I think the answer will be probably hybrid, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, if you're transacting, if you're setting, let's say, $1 million worth, you probably don't care about the $1 transaction fee of the base layer, yeah. Right? And with that amount of money, you don't want to get rugged. You don't want to get, you know, stolen. You don't want to immigrate it to screw you over. You're happy to pay the dollar on the base layer. But let's say you're tipping, you know, 5 cents to some publisher somewhere, you know, some writer, some blogger who you thought, okay, that was great. I love the story. I want to, you know, kick back a tip to them, right? That can be Lightning, in fact. So it may actually be that you put most of your money in the base layer Proton wallet and you do big transactions on the base layer. And then you have a smaller custodial Lightning, you know, Proton wallet, where you have a smaller amount of money. And it's money that, you know, it's like money you have in your wallet, right? You might get mugged, but it's probably not the end of the world if you get your wallet stolen. And that might be the medium that we need to strike. So it's a combination of what we have today, plus, you know, custodial Lightning for other use cases. It's a licensing nightmare. I can tell you that, right?
Oh yeah.
Because once you get into custody, it's a different ballgame. But I think something like that is probably the direction that we go, as opposed to trying to be insisting on, you know, self custody and Lightning at the same time. Because I think that's probably not very practical, or is it realistic in the near term?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And so, you know, we've covered a lot today. Is there anything else with regard to the wallet that we failed to touch on? Anything else that we should clarify, or did we do a pretty good broad coverage of it?
Yeah, I think we covered quite a bit. So this is probably and also in the end, Proton is responsive to the community. So if we didn't answer the question that you had, find us on Twitter or X, go to our, you know, wallet subreddit, ask us there. Well, you're our customer and our user, so we're obliged to answer you, right? So we're happy to take more questions, of course. One of the questions that comes up quite a bit is, when is the waiting list you know, going away? When are we going to make it general availability? When everybody come on? And yeah, I don't know the answer, right? But what I can say is we're hoping this year. So for those that are on waiting lists, we're working on inviting you as quickly as possible. Actually, the demand was way more than we anticipated. And look, it's not easy to get 100 million people onto Bitcoin, right? You want to do that correctly. So thank you for your patience. We're doing our best to get it, you know, as quickly as possible. And yeah, we hope you'll come and try out Proton Wallet one day and you know, see how it's a bit different.
I love it. Unrelated question. What makes you hopeful about the future? There's a lot of darkness and people get very nihilistic about things, but you seem to be a very positive. Well, I guess, you know, also I just realized the name Proton makes a lot more sense now that I know that you were a physicist. So it's a very positively charged atmosphere, it seems there.
Yeah, it could have been electron, right? But that would have been too negative.
Exactly.
As the joke goes. I don't think I am particularly a positive, person overall, right? In fact, you'll meet a lot of tech founders that have kind of drunk their own Kool-Aid and, you know, has gotten to their heads and basically, promise the world. But I think also Proton turns 10 this year, right? It turned 10 this summer, and 10 years is a long time in tech. It's like a lifetime. You know, at 10, you're practically a dinosaur. But unlike the dinosaurs, you also survive extinction, right? Because most tech companies don't make it to 10 because 9 out of 10 of them go out of business. So what I think, you know, it's not a certain optimism. It's more a certain resilience. And my main resilience is, of course, there will be more challenges to come, but we have, as an organization, dealt with so much shit over the past decade that we're just not so scared about the future, because a lot of bad things have already happened. We've already been through, we've been through all the ups, but also a lot of the downs as well. And I think the resilience makes you a little bit better equipped to deal with the uncertainty, the chaos, the negativity, and the problem in the world out there, because you're clear-eyed on your vision. And, I actually believe what we're doing at Proton, we're on the right side of history. I think we're doing something that is actually better for the world. And I believe the average person out there on the street, if you ask them if they like Google's vision of the future of the internet versus Proton's vision, they like, our vision, actually. So there's a resilience that comes from 10 years of experience and 10 years of, ups, but also, very, deep downs. Combine that with the fact that I think we're doing the right thing and we're on the right side. So that's probably, what gives me the optimism that, that you perceive. And there is something to be said for being right, right? You know, if you're right, in the long run, you're probably going to win. It could take a long time, but I think there's a lot of power to being right. And maybe this is the message that, I would leave the audience with, right? So, if you're right and you're doing the right thing, things will generally work out. My experience of the past 10 years.
I think that's fantastic advice. And last question, I promise, but are you reading anything right now that you would recommend? I always like to ask just in case some interesting recommendations come out.
At the current moment, no. And look, a lot of my readings is like, different team management books, which I can't really recommend because it's a very eclectic, topic. Some good books that I've read recently, there's a Proton user. He's actually an activist, from Hong Kong, called, Nathan Law. And he wrote a book that was basically, his life story, how he went from, for fighting democracy in Hong Kong, became one of the youngest legislators that was elected, and the whole story about how freedom disappeared in Hong Kong in a span of a couple of years. I found that to be really a quite good book, because here in Switzerland or out in the US or in Western Europe, you can't really imagine, these freedoms disappearing. But yet, our democracy and our freedom is incredibly fragile. And when you read a book like that, that's from someone that has seen it in a place where freedom actually vanished overnight, you get a sense that, what we're fighting for is actually quite important. And it's worth fighting for, because these freedoms taken for granted today, they're really, really fragile. And we can lose them in a blink of an eye. Laws can change, people can change, governments can change. One thing that doesn't change, no matter how hard you try, and I know because I'm a physicist, is the laws of mathematics. So I like the fact that, we ensure freedom through math. And this is something that, I can rely on. And this is something that I'm confident to go out to users and say, you're safe because of math.
I can't imagine a more perfect note to end on than that. Andy, this was really a pleasure to talk to you. Great to take a peek behind the curtain and just understand how you guys operate and hear this story. I think people are really going to enjoy this, and appreciate you guys making yourself so open to questions about this from the community. I'll link your details as well, but otherwise, should people just go to your website to find out more info? Anywhere else you want to send them?
Yeah, I think our website has a lot of information, but also Twitter, Reddit, we're there in the community, quite active. It's pretty easy to find us. Let us know what you think. And ultimately, our roadmap is what people ask for, right? So you tell us what you want, and we will build it, of course, within the constraints of our business, right? So if you tell us to build an ad system and to do an ad business model, not going to happen. But, other requests, we're happy to honor.
Good to know. And folks can find you on... find Proton Wallet and Proton Mail on Nostr as well, which is great, because I know we have a lot of listeners who are deep into that as well. So Andy, thank you so much for your time. This was a pleasure, and really looking forward to trying Proton Wallet out as the latest piece of my Proton stack.
Yes. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and always happy to come on and answer some questions.
Thanks so much. I'm just... And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving the show a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I always appreciate it. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. If you want to follow the Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @titcoinpodcast and @walkeramerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@walkeramerica and @walkeramerica on Rumble. Or just go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast and find links everywhere. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.